Good afternoon, everyone. Can everybody hear? Is this working okay? Good. Okay. I'm Lorna Kelly from Greater Glasgow and Clyde Health Board, and I'm very pleased to welcome you all to this, the fourth lecture in the current Glasgow Centre for Population Health seminar series. A couple of practicalities. We're not expecting any fire alarms this afternoon, so if the alarm does go off, then head for the exit. I believe if you follow Andrew Lyon, who's wandering around at the edge there, he'll show you where to go in the event of a fire. And there may be an announcement shortly before closing time asking everybody to leave the building, so please ignore that if it does happen. You're not expected to stand up and walk out. Really pleased to welcome today Wayne Elliott, who is the head of the health programme at the Met Office. And the health programme has been doing some really interesting work over the past few years, looking at the impact of the weather on health, both in terms of a short-term and immediate impact, and also the much longer-term impacts of climate change. Wayne's been working in the Met Office for about 25 years, I think, so has a huge amount of experience on the subject. And you might also recognise him from his previous role in the Met Office as Chief Press Officer, when he was called upon to comment on everything from the weather at Wimbledon to the causes of floods in Cornwall. A number of people in this room have been involved in discussions over the last few weeks about the Glasgow effect. Recognise certainly a few faces from that. And that's the effect whereby Glasgow seems to have a much higher level of mortality, a much higher death rate than you might expect, given our population and the levels of deprivation. And we never have a conversation about the Glasgow effect without somebody saying, well, it's all down to our beautiful weather that we have in Glasgow. So I don't know whether Wayne will be able to solve that dilemma for us, but I think it certainly shows that we all instinctively understand that there's a connection between weather and health, even if we don't quite know what that is. So I'm really pleased to hand over to Wayne and hope that he can provide some informed comment on something that we all like to chat about. So thank you very much, Wayne.
Thank you, Lorna, and thank you, Andrew, for inviting me up here. It's nice to see so many faces, and I've been delving a little into your backgrounds to find out the range of the audience here, so I gather it's quite a wide, dispersed set audience today. I'm going to talk through a range of issues, really, and I'm quite happy to wander off topic, really. I've got a range of issues from looking at the weather and aspects of that, how it affects the country and the culture and the inhabitants of this country, out to the longer range in climate change, what we could see and what we're expecting, what we're sure of and what we're less sure of. I'm quite happy to take any questions at any point, and at some point I may wander off in front of the stage here and just throw my arms around a little and ask you some questions or whatever to get you involved. But please feel free to have a two-way at any point here. So if you don't quite understand any point I'm trying to get over or see anything on the slides, for instance, that I'm not explaining correctly, please do ask. So as you can see from my title and my introduction, really, I head up the health programme at the Met Office. So the Met Office is the UK's National Weather Service. It's been going for 154 years now. So a long-established institute, one of the original meteorological offices around the world, which was set up. The UK and Norway really led the field in establishing meteorology and many of the concepts that we have these days and that we take for granted. And we're still at one of the world's leading national weather centres. Although quite small by comparison with many countries, we punch above our weights. And we're also possibly, arguably, the world's leading centre for climate research. It started off with the opening of the Hadley Centre in 1990, when a significant bit of money was put into climate research by Margaret Thatcher at the time, to her credit, I say, no political intent here intended. But being a scientist herself, she did have the foresight to see that the climate was changing. What the scientists were telling her had some grounds and was worth investigating, and she opened the Hadley Centre at the Met Office. In fact, in 1990, I'll just set the scene here in terms of how we moved on in 20 years. May 1990, on the Tuesday, the first IPCC report was presented to the world in a small hotel in Windsor, down in near London. So a small group of journalists, about eight, and a small group of scientists led by the Met Office presented this report. On the Tuesday, The Director General of the Met Office was asked to go and present the findings of this report to the Prime Minister and the Cabinet Office, and he went along, and it was the first time a projector had been used in the Cabinet rooms. So with the flimsy viewfalls, you remember those? So these newfangled and projecting onto the wall there, and that was the first time, only 20 years ago. And then on the Thursday, Margaret Thatcher opened the Hadley Centre of the Met Office. So three great days in climate science history, really, which set the scene for the following 20 years. So we're an organisation that's based in Exeter in the southwest of England. Only 1,700 people work there, and mostly scientists and a range of other skills and disciplines. But I head up the health programme, and within my team of, well, the core group are 12 people with a mixture of clinical backgrounds, research backgrounds. I'm a meteorologist by training and various other skills, but they tap into the broader range of research at the organisation into weather and climate research. We've got two big areas of research at the Met Office which look into those two timescales. But essentially it's about physical modelling of the atmosphere and the oceans. It's about understanding through the laws of physics and mathematics what will happen in a dynamical sense. And we found it translates really quite well towards the medical community, looking at modelling illnesses and modelling, tracking disease as it progresses. So it all started really around about 10 years ago when a doctor came to the Met Office called William Bird, and he'd been looking at weather and health for some time, and he basically approached us as an organisation and said, would you work with me as you look into weather and health to a greater extent? And so we employed him. We took him on, and he's only recently left. He was my predecessor, actually. And we really took this into a new dimension. And it's an area of research, and then the translation of that research into services, where the UK leads the world, without a shadow of doubt. I've been traipsing the boards internationally, speaking at different conferences over the last year, and it's clear that other institutions have done a lot of research into aspects of the environment on health, but no one has actually translated it into information for people so they can actually take direct action to help themselves. And that, I think, back to what Lorna was saying about our interest as a nation in the weather. Well, frequently, you know, the topic of conversation is the weather. And what else do we talk about apart from the weather? It's our health. And so the two subjects sit very nicely together. The context of what I'm going to talk about really are a little bit about the weather. I sometimes, as a weatherman, forget that people do actually like to hear a little bit about the weather and why it is how it is. So sometimes I gloss over it a little too quickly, eager to move on, but I will dwell on that a little. What areas of illness, stroke, wellness that we look at? Because our basic remit here is to keep people well. I mean, the health sector is complex enough as it is. The NHS is a complex animal, as many of you will know. And the Met Office being involved as a weather organisation is a bit odd. And people often give me quizzical looks as to why are you here? And unless we can help, we really shouldn't be muddying the waters any. And so we really are in the game to try and assist. Our culture is about prediction, it's about prevention. We put our neck on the line, whether it be at the two-day range to say what it'll be like on Friday or Saturday, out to seasonal, monthly, decadal, and out to 100 years ahead. And we don't mind doing that. That's what we're paid to do. I'll talk about how the health programme's set up, just a slide on that, for some people may find that of interest, and then the future climate. So, this is not new. No way is this new. Hippocrates in 400 BC actually understood that the weather and the climate played a big part in how people felt. I think in the intervening years we've kind of lost something. We've had the onset of modern medicine, the pharmaceuticals playing a great role in keeping people well, the public health agenda, both internationally and within the UK. And I think we kind of forgot some of the basics, and had a very interesting chat with Andrew this morning about some aspects of how maybe the discussion is changing around sustainability, about whether the current life we lead, is it sustainable, can we go on into the future? And maybe it's the time I would propose to revisit some of the old ways of thinking about ourselves and our links to the environment. Let's talk weather. Right, okay. We sit at a crossroads in weather terms. No, there's no doubt about that here on this bunch of islands in the northwest of Europe. What I've tried to bring out there, the colour of the arrows dictates the temperature, and the risk is pretty straightforward. It's whether the weather coming from that direction generally, in general terms, offers a high or low risk. Straight away, I think you'll pick out that generally when the wind or the weather's coming from a more westerly direction, it tends to not raise the level of impact on human health to a great extent. And there's good reasons for that. Our prevailing weather comes from the west. So I suggest, and evidence points to this, that we've become acclimatized, we've become adapted, either through our own physiology, our own makeup, or the way we live our lives. So the way we build our houses, we live in our houses, the way we work, the way we eat, the way we move around through day and night. And I think it's largely steered by the way the wind blows, the way the weather comes at us from the west. Let's take the high-risk arrows as an example of the opposite effect. When we have heat waves in this country, when we have high-temperature events, the wind's coming from the southeast pretty much all the time. So a south or southeast flow, very light winds bringing warm air from the continent during summer months. And that brings a multitude of factors, generally high temperatures, which has its own impact on people. And poor air quality is also linked with wind from that direction during the summer months. So they're the principal reasons that I've put high risk next to that blue arrow. They're in the months of June, July and August typically. When we look at the east and the northeast, they're predominantly winter facets of our weather. And when the wind swings around to that direction, as we're seeing now with the snow starting to set in through the next 6-12 hours, the wind's swinging around to the north, of course. Whether it brings snow or not, the fact that the temperature goes down does offer a higher risk to health. And you can see that in the health statistics. So in a very straightforward way, I'm trying to characterise the British weather, because I think then you see that through many of the arguments that come out in the public health debate. I won't yet offer it as an answer to the Glasgow effect, but we'll just park it for the moment. So what does my team get involved with? Well, we've got two areas of work. On the left-hand side, what we call our sort of public health services. These are our kind of generic messages that go out through the media, through websites, through newspapers, through press releases and comment from various people. So Harry Burns will stand up and say something, I might stand up and say something on the media. When we've got high temperature events, severe cold weather, or, well, UV, not so much. I mean, the UV service is something that runs in the background. It's the science behind how much UV exposure people are getting. And, you know, sometimes it takes a high position within the media, sometimes not. Mostly it's a kind of background service of some interest. But the heatwave service, for instance, Scotland is one of the few countries in Europe not to have a heatwave service. Funny. I was here this morning talking to Harry Burns, the CMO, directly trying to influence him to get the Scottish Government to have a heatwave plan for Scotland, because I believe the country needs one now, let alone 5, 10, 15 years. Because the impacts on the health of particularly the Central Belt, during even the current temperature regime during the summer, is there. I mean, 24, 25 degrees in the day starts to affect people who have vulnerabilities, let alone 28, 29, and Scotland does get, believe it or not, 30, 31 degrees. It has in the past, it will do in the future, and on an ever more frequent basis. So I think it's an important mark in the sand that Scotland has a heatwave plan, so I'm here to try and convince the powers that be that that's the case. But it's interesting to see your reaction. That's what Harry did, he laughed. Okay, on the right-hand side is the more interesting, I would suggest, areas of work. More bespoke, more tailored services, which are really looking at different areas of ill health. And the two areas that we have got other areas of research, but the two I want to just bring out now, I'll go into one of them to a decent level of detail, is the first one, which is our service for people with respiratory disease. So there's a condition called COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which is emphysema and bronchitis, facets of those two conditions. It's a smoker's disease. It's very common in places like Glasgow and Birmingham, Manchester and London. High prevalence rates in those areas. And once you have it, you have it. It's a pretty nasty condition. Kills you typically within 10 years of, have been diagnosed. And the weather is a major contribution to killing those people. People are diagnosed, they're generally quite well, possibly still working, but they suffer a series of what can be called attacks or exacerbations, and there's clear links with low temperatures in particular. And I'll explain our role in trying to keep people well and to stop that decline of people with that condition. Brighter Outlook, I'll mention just in passing, that's a service for people with SAD, seasonal affective disorder. Now, as a group, as a programme, I've been kind of fending off SAD for many years. Lots of press would call during gloomy summers to say, what about people with SAD? What about people with, you know, you must be doing something in that, and we weren't. But what actually happened was the director of mental health services in a primary care trust in England came to see me a year and a half ago and said they'd questioned all their people who use mental health services in their region and asked them what they thought of the services and any other issues. And number three on the list was weather makes me feel worse or better, depending whether it's cloudy or sunny. And he came along to my office and said, would you look into this? So we developed a service for people with SAD. In around about 6 weeks, actually, we turned it around. And really, it's a forecast of light. The basis of which, it runs through the winter months, and this is where I think the Glasgow discussion becomes interesting, because there is quite a body of evidence that suggests that the low light levels in these latitudes, and particularly with the type of weather that you get in the central belt, particularly in Glasgow, which is a cloudier regime, the depth of the cloud, the extent of the cloud, the longevity of cloud cover does affect people's health. And we've been running this service as a pilot in three different regions through two winters now. It's really interesting to see. And I did put some literature out at the front, and some of you will have picked up some of that. That's the flyer on it. It's just to give you some information. I didn't bring enough for everyone, I'm afraid, but if you're particularly interested, I can send any of this literature out to you if you let me have your name and address. But that's got a kind of an overview of what happened in the first year. And it was really interesting. What did people do? Well, we armed them with a patient pack at the start of the season. So this little brochure here tells them about their condition, tells them how weather affects them, and it tells them what they can do to help keep themselves well. So exercise, diet, keeping their drug regime going, that sort of thing. So, stays quiet, nothing happens, until we see a prolonged period of cloudy weather in that particular location. And then they receive an alert. So they receive an SMS or an email alerting them to the fact that you can expect cloudy conditions for the next 2 days. Now, okay, all well and good, you think that may or may not be clever in your mind, but what they are encouraged to do is A, seek help from CBT, cognitive behavioural therapy, which they get a little booklet on, and also use of a light box. So some of them may have used light box light therapy before, which is proven to help, but they may have come home, switched the thing on for 3 hours, watched some TV, had a cup of tea, and then actually switched it off, put it in the cupboard, and found it didn't actually make any difference to them. By targeted use of that box for 30 to 40 minutes before the period of gloomy weather is coming, that's the sort of thing I'm trying to get across in this context, is it's about a combination of interventions which you're laying out to people they can readily use and access and think about self-managing their condition. I'll come back to Bright Outlook if you wish, but that's all I plan to say on that. Climate services for health, well, really that's about climate change and addressing the health agenda, looking at a changing climate. Thinking about cold, which is fairly topical on a day like this, obviously, the four worst countries coping with winter weather are the four Western European countries, which backs up my suggestion earlier that the direction of the wind is a predominant factor. So Portugal, Ireland, Spain and the UK are the four worst countries by some measure. And within the UK, all the four countries are pretty much the same, actually, in terms of their mortality rate. But last winter, this is the winter before the one we're just finishing, the increase in mortality was 47% across the UK. This year we're sitting on some, again, pretty horrific mortality figures. And certainly the Department of Health for England are really keen to try and understand why this is the case. And I'm working with a couple of research institutes to try and look at that in quite a lot of detail. And in that we'll look at the statistical relationship, the epidemiological relationship, and also the behavioural relationship that is driving people to be exposed to the winter. There's a big story there, I mean, but it's not easy as to how to answer the question. On to COPD. Well, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease is a massive killer in the UK. I've put some UK figures and some US figures there because I was over in the States doing a similar talk. It's the most common cause of admission to hospital from a pre-existing condition, and the burden on the NHS is rising. And so clearly, with a link to the weather, which is so clear, there's something that we can do. So what do we do? Well, this is a temperature curve, a temperature graph. The white line is the actual admissions in a unit in South East London, actually, but we've got many examples of this. This is a period in 2004, from February through to end February, start of February. And the zero line is the kind of standardised admission that you'd expect at that time of year in that unit, okay, in that region. But this is what actually happened. This is more like what should have happened. And the horizontal white bar is a period of cold weather, low temperatures, and in fact some snowfall. And what you see, and this comes out time and time again, is respiratory disease tends to kick in around about 10 to 12 days. Admissions due to an influence like this, in this case a weather event, tends to happen around about 10 to 12 days later. There's other conditions kick in here, cardiovascular disease being one of them. But the COPD link, the respiratory disease link, is quite clear, and it's quite well established at that time out. So straight away you can see what I'm going to suggest here is that we know this is coming. And we know it's about here, actually. Temperature is one of the easiest things to forecast. There are other things like snowfall which are harder. But temperature is a pretty basic element to get right in weather forecasts these days. So if you can change behaviour around here, you hopefully don't get the impact. That's essentially what we're trying to do. We're trying to take out that spike at the 10 to 12 days. And that's where we can help, is by removing that. Because it's admissions, it's unplanned admissions, which cost the NHS the most money, as some of you will be well aware, I'm sure. But we don't just look at the weather. It's not a weather forecast in itself. What we end up doing is predicting risk. And this is a key aspect of what I'm here to say, really. It's about communication. It always, in my experience, is. I was a meteorologist for many years, trying to communicate a weather forecast to a variety of people, from North Sea oil rig workers to helicopter pilots to people running our gas supplies and energy supplies and many, many others. And it's always about communication. The science of weather forecasting is fit for purpose these days, but you wouldn't believe it from the criticism that most people are attuned to. And it's almost totally down to communication. It's about a misunderstanding and that final link in terms of a delivery of a message to an end user. And it's our problem. It's not the general public's problem at all. We need to be very sensitive, be very aware of how we communicate to people. So in this context, this is a forecast of risk. And what we do is we take other aspects of the environment into the model, if you like, our algorithm, which is a health predictor. And so we take the weather, we take the humidity as well, and we take circulating respiratory virus. So levels of influenza-like virus which are circulating in and around the community at any one point. So we take a weekly feed of that from the health authorities and combine it with the weather data. I'll explain a little more how it works in a moment. But who do we aim this at? Well, there's the profile of people with COPD. Mostly, the yellow line, the yellow box, the yellow area in the graph, of people who are perhaps only recently diagnosed, perhaps only been into hospital maybe once, fairly well people, you might say. These people who are really quite poorly in the blue area here are generally case managed. They are very well watched. They are on oxygen pretty much all the time. So their level of risk and exposure to risk is totally different, and they don't show any difference through the year. But that's not the case with the people who are newly diagnosed. And so the benefit comes in trying to keep these people out of hospital. Because A, they're off the radar of the GP, and they're the ones which you hoped to be keeping well and out of hospital. So how does it work? Well, this is the system as it's set up. The Met Office is in the box at the top. So we're taking in the health data and the weather data. This is the NHS. The NHS Scotland in here, this white box. And here's the patient down here. Now, at the start of the year, the patient comes onto this system. They decide they want to take it, and I won't go into the ways and means of how that's offered. But it involves the GP, it involves the patients, and it involves us. So when we're monitoring the situation on a weekly basis, and when we see the risk as being elevated, so we have two states, we either have normal or elevated, and when through a combination of the weather and the virus load, the risk is elevated, we trigger the service. And so we activate it by the push of a button at this point here. We go into the NHS, we look at the areas that are affected, and we look for patients' telephone numbers. We look for people's contact details. And then this system here actually makes telephone calls out to these people. So it's an automated service that actually rolls out an interactive telephone call to these people. At the same time, it sends an email to the GP to say, we're going to call your patients. Okay, so they know it's going to happen. And then in a 24-hour period, at the moment, there's about 35,000 people across the UK on this service, and they, within a 24-hour period, all receive these alerts telling them that they're at increased risk of becoming unwell. They answer two questions. Yes or no is the answer. One is, are you feeling well? The other is, have you got enough medication for the next 2 weeks? And they say yes or no to those two questions. The answers to those come back into the system, come back in here, and are sent to the GP the next day. So they get a follow-up email to say, your patients have all been contacted, and here's the results. And so if this GP has got, say, 300 COPD patients on the system, previously they would not have known the state of those patients, I suggest. In some cases, rare occasions in my experience, then there's a good handle of their COPD register. But probably they were blind to the state of those. But now they can see perhaps 270 of them are fine, and then 30 of them have got a combination of either needing more medication or are feeling unwell. So it lets them be proactive with those 30 who stand out there. So that's the mechanism, in this case, how we've used, and that's why I mentioned earlier about the communication. How this service started off was, it stopped here. Didn't have this bit, only had all this bit. So we used to forecast the risk, and we used to send a fax, actually, it was in the days of fax, in practice to say, we think your COPD patients are at greater risk of becoming unwell. What happened was the fax curled up and fell on the floor, and no action happened, of course. Nothing ever happened. And so all that information, that potential benefit, was lost. And only by bringing in this last bit do you actually get benefit to the patient. And the patients, we were quite nervous about introducing it. Patients absolutely love it. Some don't, but most absolutely. And many look forward to the telephone call, believe it or not. Because a lot of the many thousands of... We questionnaired a lot of the patients for the first few years. Most said the biggest issue for them was lack of contact with other people. And my first comments about the way we live our lives these days, that's the biggest single factor which comes through in the feedback. They just want contact, and they see it as somebody's watching out for them. It doesn't seem to matter that it's actually an automated call. Not what we expected at all. So what do people do about it in this case? Well, it's about simple measures. These are clinically recognised measures that they can take. The most obvious one that they can do is to report their symptoms early. As soon as they start to feel perhaps a little loss of appetite or unwell, if they bother to look after themselves and report their symptoms, they stand a much better chance of staying out of hospital. I'll probably breeze past this quite quickly in terms of how my programme is set up, but basically we're split into three different areas: pure research, applied sort of translational research, and then kind of business activity, really, kind of getting the service out there. But so in summary, in terms of weather and health, the key issues really are understanding the relationship between the weather and certain health impacts, understanding the group of people who are at risk within the population, and then trying to elicit behavioural change through effective communication. I mean, this is not rocket science in essence, really. People know what to do. GPs know that people are at risk. People know that cold weather generally makes them worse. But it's built on the premise of something called nudge theory, that it's okay, everyone's getting on with their lives, but they need a little trigger, a little nudge at the right time to instigate an action. And if they're seeing Heather on telly talk about colder weather coming in a few days, and then they get a call as well, they know the risk applies to them. The overwhelming evidence from people, older people primarily, who when they're told that the weather's coming, bad weather's coming and they need to take care, they think, well, I'm all right, it's Joan down the road who's at risk. She's always falling over in the slippy conditions, or she's got that bad cough or whatever. Predominantly, people think it's not just older people, but don't think the risk doesn't apply to them. They offload the understanding onto others. They've got the problem, not me. So this is really an attempt at trying to make it clear that, no, it's you. It is actually you that's got the condition, and we're trying to keep you well and help you self-manage your condition better. So, have you any questions, any points on kind of weather and health and particularly respiratory disease? Yes, sir?
Have you found the issue of driving rain and wind and temperature together have influenced the western side because of what's driving rain?
It does. Yeah, wind clearly does make people feel worse with this particular condition. That's frequently reported. Very hard to measure and very hard to warn of. People going out to the shops, maybe sheltered in one street, they turn around the corner, they get a full blast down the street around the corner. So actually trying to add useful comment to that individual, or significant numbers of individuals in that context, has proved a real challenge. Originally we did have it in there and we took it out because it was complicating the issue. Because you tend to get your lowest temperatures when the wind is very slack, when you get still air. And you tend to get the greatest wind chill effect when you get, obviously, the wind blowing and you've got a decent degree of cold. So it's a strange combination of wind and temperature. We've kept it simple at this stage. Yes?
Presumably, the ability to keep your house warm and well insulated is also very important for people with respiratory disease. And then noticed that featured in the risks. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, one of the key things is this is the patient pack for people taking that respiratory disease. And at the back, there's a little magnetic card which the people put on their fridge as a reminder of what to do. But there's two thermometers. These bend over and you can just rip them out. One you put in your lounge and one in your bedroom. And you keep your bedroom at 18 degrees and your lounge at 21 Celsius, not above the fire or the radiator, where we frequently find them, unfortunately. But it's a measure. Again, people get quite excited and animated about just a simple feature like that. Tell them what will help look after themselves and tell them the measure of which they're looking for, 21 Celsius in their living room. Now, this opens up the whole fuel poverty issue, which I strongly suspect you're touching on. We don't get involved as an organisation. It's not really our job. We work quite closely with what was Help the Aged, is now Age UK, as an older person's charity, to work. They work with government, and we communicate with them quite well, and they support this quite strongly. But we tend to not get involved. It's a political. We are civil servants in the end, as the Met Office, and we shouldn't get involved with that kind of issue. Sorry, I ducked that one completely. Yes, sir.
I just wondered if there's a difference in uptake rates between different social groups for this kind of intervention.
Well, we deliver this in 8 different languages, so English and Welsh, and then six other languages. The uptake of those is interesting. Many health boards and PCTs said you can't operate in our area without offering in Punjabi and Bengali and Urdu. But the uptake from those groups has been limited. In terms of the translation of the call or the pack, what's happening in those households is the younger men, the cultural aspects are coming out, that younger members of the family are taking the call and translating it for their older, maybe their parents who've got the condition, and almost caring for them in that context. So in the kind of the race aspect of it, it's predominantly English-speaking people who've taken the service. but there is the facility to for others too, but it's a limited uptake at the moment. In terms of socio-economic issues, it's very mixed. I mean, we've got really wealthy areas where you can definitely see it's more of a middle-class type thing, but then we've got some really sort of gritty urban areas where people are trying to use this to reduce inequalities, because it's a fairly straightforward intervention, and you don't have to, you know, self-management is anybody's responsibility, really, and right, I would say, that's the word I'm after, right. What was interesting is the responses to the call. You see big differences in the different areas and taking the call right the way through to the end and answering all the two questions. The most, by far and away, year after year, the biggest area in terms of response rate is Moray in Scotland. And we're not sure why, but we think this actually reflects the culture of people living in the Moray area within Scotland. Very different to some of the inner city areas, particularly in London and Birmingham, the north of England, where the rate is down at around sort of 60%, 65%. Moray stands at 90% plus. So 92% it was last year, people actually picked the phone up, they were in, they answered the call and through to a successful completion, because the GP can see how many calls were successfully completed and how many weren't.
Probably snowed in.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned 21 degrees and 18 degrees. Is that for general health, optimal temperatures for general health, or is that particularly for these people that aren't well?
It's particularly with people with respiratory disease. Mm-hmm. We do patient days quite often, and I did one recently near my hometown, and a queue of people formed to talk to you after, many of them on oxygen. And one older lady, very serene, elegant older lady, said she had always had lots of them keep their windows open at night, in their bedrooms particularly. And it isn't the right thing to do. I'm speaking as a meteorologist here, but this is acquired knowledge from GPs. They should not have their windows open at night. That is definitely a detrimental thing to do when you have COPD. She'd shut her window when taking the service, as it recommends in here, and her condition had changed overnight, completely changed its characteristics. She'd been much better off after that. And it's different for different people. A lot of people with COPD are frightened of becoming out of breath. They associate becoming out of breath with having an attack, an exacerbation. Whereas if anybody in this room walked quickly around the block, you'd be out of breath, or ran up the stairs from the ground floor, you'd be out of breath, and you'd accept that as being normal behaviour. But it's kind of normalising, within the right context, that aspect of being alive. And that's what we've been able to do, working in conjunction with the NHS. I mean, this is not us taking a health lead at all. Don't misinterpret me here at all. This is us taking a back seat to the health, supporting the health practitioner. Does that answer your question? Sort of. It does within respiratory disease. I don't know beyond that.
Right.
So I certainly wouldn't like to comment for other areas of ill health. But it definitely is for this. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was astonished that always your first slide, that the brighter, drier, sunnier east coast of Scotland was high risk in terms of health and weather, and the dull, damp west coast, which certainly has statistics to match that description, was low risk. Could you say more about that?
Those hours don't reflect it's healthier or more at risk on the east side. It's showing you that when the weather comes from that direction, the general risk to the population of the UK is elevated, is higher risk. So no, I don't. No, that's definitely a misinterpretation of the map. It's showing you when the wind's in the east or the northeast during the winter, it generally brings colder weather, pretty much to sea. Colder weather has an obvious. Detrimental impact upon the health of the population. It's not about east and west. You're absolutely right in what you say. The west is cold, is wetter, damper, cloudier. The dry, pretty much all the way down the east coast of the UK, is sunnier and drier. And it is therefore more healthy for that respect. A lot of people retire to the east coast and certainly down in England on that east coast to get away from the cloud and the damp. Good reason for that. Okay, so looking at the longer range, just a few slides on the longer term. A lot of unfortunate public disquiet about the science, the climate science. It's a real shame that a few people, a few stray emails, a few misworded actions, obviously wrong, clearly wrong, admitted by the individuals, have served to undermine some of the extensive science and the long-ranging science, quality science, which has gone on. So I'll park that for the moment, but happy to talk about that if anybody's particularly interested. How do we know the climate's changed? The climate's always changed, of course. Climate change is a natural phenomenon to a great degree. And there are clear reasons, natural reasons, why that's the case. The two key ones are long-term changes in the orbit of the Earth. That does change, it wobbles. And variations in sun output. So solar output changes and it is rhythmic, has a cycle. And they do alter the climate. And that is well understood, has been understood for many years, and is modelled within the climate models. Volcanic activity is another major issue, and one that isn't forecastable, of course. When the big ones blow and then affect the climate for 2, 3, 4, maybe longer years, then they happen. There's no stopping them, there's no forecasting them. They do cool the climate of the planet. But it is temporary. It only lasts for typically 2 or 3 years. When Pinatubo erupted, one of the dustiest volcanoes, the cloudiest volcanoes to erupt for many years, its trace, the evidence of it was clearly there in the global temperature record for 2 to 3 years. And then the temperature recovered almost completely from that. And then there's anthropogenic factors, so humankind's activity. What gives us the basis? I'm going to simplify this at this to this extent. The basis for the two reasons why we're confident we've got it right. One is, at the Met Office, uniquely, we use the same atmospheric models to model the weather and forecast the weather as we do the longer-term climate. Now, the weather forecast is pretty near spot-on, on most occasions. Bear in mind my communication comment earlier. But generally, it has the atmosphere pretty much spot on. It takes us about an hour and 20 minutes, 4 times a day, to run a 5-day forecast for the whole planet. So what are we now? We're 20 past 4 GMT. The whole world, in meteorological terms, works on GMT still. So we're busy gathering information from around the world at the moment, down at the Met Office. And at 6 o'clock, 1800, we will run the atmospheric model again, which goes out for another 5 days, and that takes about an hour and a half. And we do that 4 times a day, day in, day out. And it gives us great confidence that the dynamics, the physics, the mathematics within the model are broadly correct. But this is an example of the kind of thing that we do. The black line is the actual, it's actually for the northern hemisphere, it's not for the whole globe, but it's pretty much the same, is the actual observed temperature through these years from 1850 up to the year 2000 and beyond. And if we only include the natural forcings, that's these two aspects here, the green line is what the models produce. So if we pretend we're in 1850 and run the model forward, the green line is what we get. The spread is because of the uncertainty. Okay, I'll come on to uncertainty later. But the spread is because of the uncertainty. And you can see there's a spread, but later on, the black line clearly goes outside the green area, and that ain't good. That's not what we want to see, because your models aren't working right, if that's the case. If you bring in human activity, that's what you get. So the anthropogenic forcings, that's the greenhouse gases, primarily CO2, but also methane and others. Water vapour has an impact as well. Then you see far better correlation with the observed temperature. That's the sort of thing which gives us great confidence that we've got it right, and the atmospheric models at the longer range are broadly correct. This is a northern hemisphere again, temperature trend for back to the year 1000. In the recent past, when thermometers were available, accurate and available, then we've seen an approximate, it's about 0.78 now, it's getting up towards 0.8 degrees temperature rise. Okay, that's what we've seen in this latter bit. What are we expecting? Well, these are the IPCC scenarios. These are the lower and the upper range, depending on how much CO2 we eventually end up actually emitting. And it's somewhere in the middle of that plume. Probably where things are going, this is off the record, but this is not too, we're going for around about 2 to 3 degrees at the moment with our current behaviour and our current emissions. The EU avoiding dangerous climate change limit, how to avoid what global temperature rise to limit in terms of being confident that we would not see any disastrous consequences, it's 2 degrees. We're pretty much past that now in terms of what we've emitted even over the last 2 to 3 years. So we're probably edging up towards the centre part of that. But an interesting facet of the CO2 actual emissions that we're measuring, the emissions are above the top end of the IPCC scenarios. So at the moment, we're here, so at the moment, the CO2, this is temperature, but the CO2 emissions are above what this, which would drive the highest temperature range there. So that's not encouraging, really, in terms of global CO2 output. Okay, so we get 2 degree temperature rise globally. That is not the story. That is definitely not where our concern should lie. And I've got a summary slide coming up which kind of brings this out. The big concern is extremes. And the extremes really are about temperature and rainfall. Because if you move, these are normal distributions, so two of the temperature. So this is our current climate, let's say, this one on the left. So this is the mean temperature sitting in the middle. And these are outliers, so these are cold events. And this is a warm event here, and I've drawn a line there. If you move the whole distribution to the right by 2 degrees, if we keep your trigger point of what we call hot weather in the same place, you can see the area under the ground that you now characterise as hot weather, and therefore extreme weather and potentially damaging to health, becomes far greater. So you increase your chances of getting an extreme event substantially more than your mean temperature rise. And that's the essence of the concern, because the extremes will come in far, far quicker. And interestingly, what will happen is, and we've seen it this last 2 years, people will become less able to cope with these at the bottom end as well. So when you do get cold events, which you clearly will, people think because it's snowed that global warming is off the agenda. That is absolutely not the case, of course. You will continue to get cold events and hot events. And when you get these, people will become less able to deal with them. One graph, try and finish this little bit off really, to bring out that. This is the summer of 2003. This is the reason that I was with Howard Byrne this morning. Because this killed an estimated, between 35 and 50,000 people in Europe, this heat wave in 2003. The black line again is the observed temperature that we've seen in Europe, and the red line are the simulated, so the model, the predictions. Interestingly, this year that we saw in 2000, which was a complete outlier, took everybody by surprise to happen so quickly. You can see quite quickly it's starting to happen more and more frequently. And by 2040, it's a 1 in 2 year event. So every other year you would expect that kind of summer to be happening, and that's only 30 years away. And then by 2060s, 2070, it's a cool event. We'll be looking at that summer and saying, wow, that was a cold one. Got away with it that year, didn't we? And that's a really interesting way to think about it. I've got a 3 and 5 year old, two daughters, and within their lifetime, they'll be experiencing summers which are cool, but kill 35, 50,000 people in Europe. Now, clearly society will have adapted by then. We won't as humans, but our buildings and our infrastructure must change, else we won't cope. But I think that brings in, again, the extremes and the return periods of these kind of events quite graphically, I think. This may be a little bit too much, especially at 5:30 on a Tuesday. But what I'm trying to show here is that we used to talk about uncertainty in this game, and now we don't. We talk about probability. So what is most probable? This is UK Climate Impact Programme 2002. This is a leading bit of work that the UK is well ahead of anyone else in doing. This looks at the impacts of climate change. And we used to look at a single model. We used to be able to look at what that model said and think, okay, that's the best measure in years ahead of what the climate will be like.
In the IPCC recent report, we looked at many models and reported on those, but it still didn't give you a very accurate, very mathematical way of looking at it. What we do in this UK Climate Programme 09, which was published last year, and Met Office did the science behind it, is look at all the different models and actually look at the range of the
probability of that happening. And how that actually looks is like this. What we used to get is a single projection.
Here, this is summertime rainfall. So this was showing southern England looked like around about 50 to 70, say 60% reduction in summer rainfall. Western Isles, west coast of Scotland, something like a zero change, maybe a small dip.
And you thought, okay, I don't really trust that very much. It looks a bit rubbish anyway.
What we're able to do now is actually the pixels are far smaller, so there's greater confidence there. And we have a central estimate, 50%, so that distribution there, you can look at the central bit. So here we think the southwest of England will go for something like a 60% reduction in summer rainfall. But you can see that if you're looking at, okay, if we're looking at what could happen, it's very unlikely to be less than this. So this is most of the UK seeing somewhere between a 40% and a 60% reduction.
But it's very unlikely to be less than that.
I think we're not explaining this particularly well, but hopefully those in mathematics better will understand. It's not likely to be more than this, and that kind of an around about a 10% increase.
And what this is trying to show you is that an increase in summer rainfall is possible mathematically within the models. And what we're trying to show you is the whole range of certainty. Balanced probability shows that we're down here somewhere. But there is a chance, there is an outlier, and the models are picking this up, that we could see a zero change or even a small increase. Because what this shows you is, this kind of trumps the sceptics, really, because they often lean on this sort of thing. They'll pick out this model and say, yeah, one of this model goes for a 10% increase. It's all rubbish. You can't believe it. The consensus is there. It's multi-model. It's presented in a probabilistic way. That's what we're trying to show. So greater transparency within the science really is the game here. A complex slide, really, but this is trying to show you that depending on what your role is within your job and whether you're interested in climate change and whether you think you have a part to play in it, there's different ways you can look at it. The longer range, the years range, and people who are designing, building a structure, local planning, those kind of tasks clearly need to take into account a different set of uncertainties or probabilities than at the shorter range. If you're an operations manager within an organisation, you probably need to look at this kind of area. And what I'm showing you here is that the science is attempting to link all of these timescales together. You have to take into account the degree of uncertainty that exists, because we do become less certain the longer range you go out. But there is information out there for you. Key events that will affect the UK in terms of health, cold, heat and flooding, pretty much cover it. They are the big issues in terms of the UK, but they are definitely compounded by other events. And we see this time and time again. When you get poor quality events or some economic issues, brings out the fuel poverty there. So if you get cold in deprived areas, then you see a multiplier coming in there, which makes the issue worse. Just looking at the NHS, working with them over the last few years, there's three defined areas where you can put an organisation like the NHS is very typical here. So you look at the staff who are trying to operate the system, you look at the infrastructure in which they are operating in and with, and you look at the demand upon the services. And you can look at different timescales, for instance. So you can break it down into three key areas and define those areas to a greater degree by looking at your particular area. So what do we need to do? Well, adapt and plan is the key thing. Mitigation is part of the sustainability agenda. By mitigation, that means we can do things which stop it happening. I hope I've made it clear, and I don't mean to be evangelical about it, but we are pretty much committed to a 2-degree temperature rise globally from what we've done already, and perhaps a bit more as well. And we need to adapt to those kind of issues which are going to already roll out in the next 10, 20, perhaps 30 years. But it's about planning, good quality information, understanding the timescale issue which I discussed, and helping us to communicate the science better. We've been lambasted by a range of people, mainly social scientists, who quite rightly have said you've singularly failed in getting your message across over the last 20 years. People don't really understand anything off into the 2080s. They don't understand something which is happening in Africa. They care, but they can't understand it and relate their lives to it. And we have to think about the way we communicate climate science to make it relevant. So, in summary, climate is warming, it will continue to do so. Means and extremes being particularly affected. Adaptation and prediction systems and information for people who have to make those decisions is key. So I'll leave that slide as my last one. I just want to show you one issue, because my last point there, the role of public opinion. The great similarities between the climate change agenda and the smoking agenda that happened within the 1950s and 60s. And this commercial advert from then actually shows you how things can change. Hopefully you'll be able to hear this in a moment. Just bear with me.
Technical glitch, folks. Sorry about this. It's worth waiting for. It's an advert for smoking that came out in the 50s, which had doctors actually promoting smoking. And I've lost my memory stick now, so I may not be able to show you this. And really, only when the doctors became part of the solution and started to convince people that they needed to change their behaviour, did you see a change of attitudes within smoking. And it's quite remarkable to see the change. So, just bear with me. I've lost it. I have actually lost it, so it's here somewhere. Anyway, I will finish there. While we're winding down, if I manage to find it, I'll show you it. But I hope you found that interesting. I'm happy to take any questions. Yeah, here it is. Yes, sir, goodbye.
You mentioned a few slides
about
the climate factors in terms of the organic issues and the condition of the sun and the worldly things.
Yeah. That's absolutely right.
See, the mathematical model that was done in red that was showing temperatures that were exceeding the 2003 heatwave. Yep. That is a modelling a worst case scenario. Is that a kind of, you know, if we don't do something about the anthropogenic?
Good question. I didn't say that. No, that is medium to high scenario prediction. That is, so that is not the worst case scenario. That is medium high is one often used. If you're choosing one emission scenario. Does everyone understand what I mean by an emission scenario? We could choose to change our society so that greenhouse emissions change tomorrow and took it on a downward track. We could carry on as we are, or there's somewhere in between, or getting worse, or there's somewhere in between. And what tends to be used is a kind of somewhere in between, but at the upper end, and that's what that is. So that's not the worst case scenario, absolutely not. No, sorry.
A number of the models show that the temperature of the degree rise might be above 2 degrees. There's a lot of literature suggesting now that a rise above 2 degrees might trigger tipping points.
Yes.
And I just wondered if the models beyond that take into account these tipping points, or whether that would be an additional rise on top of that if those tipping points were real and were reached.
Yeah, this is a massive area of research, and one for the next IPCC round will be featured quite heavily. The research is still ongoing. Some of them are known, the cathrates, the big methane releases from the permafrost and the sub-oceanic releases as well. Huge quantities of particularly methane, which if that started to come out, would be, well,
let's not even consider it at this point, because CO2 is potent, but nowhere near as potent as methane. So if any methane big stores, which there are several around the planet, generally well locked away, start to be released, then that is a major concern. Another is is the Arctic ice. If it's thinning, 2007 summer was a record low year. 2008 was better, but it's all about variability each year. Once you've lost the summer ice in the Arctic completely, which there is dispute about when that will happen, probably around about 20 years' time, very hard to form back again and keep, because every year the ice is new ice. You've got no year-on-year ice. And so whether they're tipping points, they're the two that come to mind quickly, but there are others. Amazon dieback is another key one, of course. And at the moment, plants generally are flourishing because the world's warmer, there's more CO2. And in most areas, there's more water, certainly in the tropics, because it's raining more. Although that's not, you know, that's quite variable. But certainly it's warmer and there's more CO2. So plants will thrive. But they come, and it has been modelled quite accurately, there comes a point where that turns around and you start to see quite rapid dieback of these big forested areas, because they can't grow any faster and they suffer other stresses. Either nutrient stresses, can't draw up the nutrients quick enough, or whatever. And so that's another tipping point, which you start to then turn the Amazon rainforest into a net contributor of carbon rather than a sink. So they're not modelled, they are being, but they're not in these models, because they are outliers and would sway it completely and would produce artificially bad results, to be honest.
Is there a day after tomorrow scenario where the fresh water from the ice, which is cool and less dense than seawater, changes the air?
It's a great film, isn't it?
But, I mean, is there any reality in...
There isn't, no.
A glacial period coming back because of...
All the climate models model the North Atlantic drift, and they model the melting of the ice caps. And what happened when we last saw the current switch off was there was a large pool of fresh water sitting across the North American continent around the Great Lakes. The Great Lakes are the residual part of that. And that all broke out into the North Atlantic very swiftly. It broke a bridge, an ice bridge, which was there, and it got out there within... I don't know, to be honest, but it's within a couple of years, say, it's that short a distance. And that swamping of the North Atlantic with fresh water is what switched it off. There's no mechanism for that to happen now. There's no pool of fresh water. The ice cap's melting gradually, steadily, slowly, and it's just weakening the North Atlantic drift. And the models capture about a 25 to 33% reduction in its strength, which causes cooling. Yeah? So if you slow that up, you cause cooling across Europe. But the warming effect of increased CO2 totally outweigh the cooling effect. It's totally dominant.
Yes. Could you say something about biodiversity and your views on how that might look in the future?
It's not my area of specialism. I won't stray very far, other than people are looking at it. It's becoming multidisciplinary. The climate scientists at the Met Office are working ever closer with other academics to try and create integrated impacts models, looking at, because if you cause a change in just the biosphere, you will change climate change, and so they are linked. One cause and effect. I don't know quite what you mean by biodiversity, as in the essence of it and what it, the fact that it's required.
Well, it's the loss of species that
we're
experiencing as well.
That's really not my area. Definitely not. That's definitely, I won't stray very far into that.
What about an increase in tropical type diseases affecting Britain as the climate bands shift further north?
Well, I was at a WHO event 2 weeks ago in Italy, and there's biggest challenges depending on where you live. The UK generally, although I've told quite a negative story here, and you will go home quite down, hopefully my little film will lift you a little bit, cheer you up. It's actually quite a positive message for the UK as it stands, if you just look at it in isolation. Our climate will become really quite pleasant. It really will. There's no point in trying to deny that. It looks like all the evidence should... And so, you know, typical dour Brits, we must be miserable and self-flagellation and all that about that. But The climate itself will actually become drier in the summer, okay, wetter in the winter, sunnier and warmer, and more conducive to outdoor living, which will help with the obesity issue and all that kind of stuff, you know, so use of our green spaces. But what else does it cause? Does it cause migration issues from people coming from different areas? Now, what came out in an interesting session at WHO was dengue fever and malaria are knocking at our door. The malaria mosquito lives in the underground in London. It has done since the 1850s in mass, huge numbers. All it's doing, it comes out and bites people, but it's got no reservoir within the human population to transfer it. That is not the case anymore. There are populations coming from other parts of the world where they have malaria in them. And if all it's needing is the malaria mosquito to bite people and then transfer it around, and they are expecting malaria outbreaks to occur through that, those means. Dengue fever is another one that's hot on its heels. I'm not a specialist in that area. I defer to my clinical colleagues in my team, but they're the two that come to mind for the UK. But it's very, very complicated, and you see interannual variations in the spread of disease because climate changes, the weather changes year on year.
It's interesting because I heard on Radio 4 London boroughs being dominated by immigrants and people from the Horn of Africa and so on. And there is obviously a huge increasing reservoir, blood reservoir from that area.
There is, yes. And the malaria mosquito lives in large numbers. Yes.
Yes,
can I ask you something that's not about climate change? I'm just curious about the actual structure of the Met Office, because you're obviously public servants and you produce all this fantastic free stuff, you know, your forecasts, and I understood from what you were saying that your public education about climate change, you're not planning to charge anybody for that. On one of your early slides, you described your health programme as a business.
Yes.
And I imagine that it, you know, a particular NHS, like NHS Scotland, maybe, wanted to use some of your health forecast services and have to pay. But I imagine there's not actually a market in that because there isn't anybody else who's got what you've got. So can you just describe a bit how that works in terms of different bits of public service, paying other bits of public
service? The Met Office is what's called a trading fund. It's an executive agency within government. And so we have to have customers for everything that we do. We're not allowed to just do things just because we like. So it generates a bit of it's a bit like the NHS, actually. It's a market economy within a public sector organisation. A lot of our services go into government, so MOD buy a lot of services from the Met Office to support aviation and that kind of activity. So within the health programme, these are delivered within the national framework. The Department of Health pay my team to deliver that. It's a nominal amount to cover the basic cost of delivering it. The Scottish Government are being asked to do the same for Scotland. It's a very low-level figure. These are sold in a more commercial way, and health boards and primary care trusts take them up and operate in a more commercial way, taking these up for their patients. This is to cover the cost of the work. At the moment, the team that I run, I do treat it like a business. I have to cover the cost of my team. The charging mechanism for these is such that it covers the cost of the investment and trying to invest more for the future. But we have to be self-financing within my team. And if I don't manage to sell these services to people, sell in the broadest sense, then I can't do the research looking at new conditions. It's the way government is run these days, and particularly agencies sitting just outside government. That probably answered all your question. I'm happy to talk about it after. There's nothing to kind of hide of anything. It's just, it can get a little bit complex, and I'd be interested in it. But we do sell NHS has commissioners, some maybe in the room. They're well used to buying services. And so it's not an environment that we find difficult for them to understand how we're approaching it. They're relatively cheap services compared with the pharmaceutical bill, for instance, that a typical PCT or health board will have to pay. Yes, sir.
Thank you. First of all, in the sceptics and the climate change argument, I think the difficulty we have there is that most of us are suspecting this the victims of what seems to be some phase of irrationality. I was going to say a claim of opinion, but that would be a pun. Irrationality and populism in a lot of public policy making.
Yeah.
You know, with a government that proposes, I suppose, as instant solutions to deep-seated social problems.
Yeah.
And then we have now this instant criminalisation of drugs based on media scare.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, we have a failure political and civic leadership in some areas where we do have to get the public to change their behaviour. And an example of that we've had recently in Scotland is the opposition parties in Parliament blocking minimum pricing for alcohol.
Yeah.
Which I have to say Scotland produces an almost unarguable evidence base for.
Yeah.
But two questions I had. One was that in regeneration just now, there's a kind of revisiting to the whole master planning and placemaking thing. And I'm wondering, is there any way in which your work that you can see feeding into that? I'm aware that there's very, very huge lemmings of people around the placemaking.
Is that the urban environment you're thinking
about?
Urban
environment, physical place, but trying to link it to local and cultural factors.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering, the first question was if you're looking into that at all. The other one, I was just a tad surprised you were saying there about we'll move into a warmer climate, albeit maybe a bit wetter. I was surprised to find myself many years ago in the same bed as Margaret Thatcher, figuratively speaking. Rather as a scientist, it was a lay organic gardener. Some 15, 18 years ago, I began to pick up really strange things were happening in the garden. And that's where I came in. Still on a completely anecdotal lay basis, for about 5 years, where I seem to be picking up this instability as well as change. And so the last two seasons, I completely missed out some of my spring sowings in my garden because I couldn't get a prolonged, mild, dry.
Okay, fine, I understand. Right, first one. Yes, we are, and I wish I had it, because it's new off the press, and it's quite an impressive image. It is of London, rather than Glasgow, which is a shame, but it's a satellite image of a heatwave day in 2006, and it shows the temperature range across the capital, so the Greater London area, and it shows, I was telling Andrew earlier, it absolutely brings the whole public health issue of urban spaces to life in a single image, because it shows you the hot spots. Very small pixels, and so it looks really quite lifelike. It's red where it's hot, it's white where it's cold, or bluey where it's cold. And you see across very short distances, in the order of 7 or 8 degree temperature ranges at midday on a hot day. And so West London, around Heathrow, anybody who knows London, and parts of North London, you saw, 34, 35 degrees. And then you see the parks and the river and the reservoirs to the west of Heathrow, down at, about 27, 28 degrees. And it shows you the importance of green spaces, of water, of urban design. If you're thinking about how to handle vulnerable people during heatwave events, where you can move them to try and, if you can instantly move people to an area which is 7 or 8 degrees cooler, if you can find some shade there, that's a good thing to do. The designer, I've got a French guy who works in my team, he can't get over how British houses are still being built. That windows still open outwards, so you can never have shutters there which can be put, because you'll have to reverse French windows come in, continental windows. And that sort of change seems to me, I'm not a building and planning expert, but it seems to me something you could perhaps instill quite quickly to protect yourself in 20 to 30 years' time, you can start to have those facets of design. On your second issue, so yes we are, but it's through the use of our technology, I think, to visualise the environment and to see the complexities within different regions. We could go on about that for quite a long time, but I hope that gives you a little bit of insight.
Just ask you, are you saying that the instability is as big a factor then as change?
Right, so your second point about your growing. Yes, I haven't come to that yet. There is a concern at the moment that what we're seeing is greater instability. We've had, I can't name them off the top of my head, but we had the 2003 heat wave, we had the 2006 major heat event, we've had flooding in Yorkshire, in parts of Scotland, we've had the Cheltenham floods. Nearly every year has seen a major weather event somewhere in the UK. And that, we're racking our brains, and look, it's hard to quantify these things, but the consistency of a different type of event each year, but which achieves quite a lot of impact, is interesting, and we're wondering, but the models wouldn't pick this up particularly, whether we are seeing greater instability. I don't know is the answer to your question, but that gets said to us quite often, and we're even picking it up within our data. But the models aren't showing that could happen. So it's a cause of concern, if anything. I mean, what happened this year with the summer, the barbecue summer, as we said, it was a near miss because London and the South East had a remarkable summer. Well, not London, it was actually further east than that. Continental Europe had a spectacular summer. And what the signals we were picking up in the ocean temperatures pointed to a very hot, very dry European summer. But we had this weather front lying right the way across the British Isles throughout the summer. And it has, I won't get into the dynamics of it, the physics of it, but if you heat up the continent very strongly, if you keep your ocean temperature pretty much the same, you create this pseudo weather front across the boundary. And we've never modelled or thought of, particularly, that what if that was located every summer across the British Isles? Just imagine. And that's what we can't model. We won't know that kind of subtlety within the climate system. I'm not saying it was. Don't quote me that Mr. Elliott said it was always going to be like this now. Yes, sir.
Can I just add on the heat sink effect that you were talking about? That brings one to mitigation, of course.
Yes.
Part of the cause of heat sink effect is, for example, air conditioning.
Yeah.
And so there is something we can do about it if we design to lessen the need for air conditioning.
Yes.
It's not needed, actually.
No.
That can have an effect as well as green spaces.
Yeah, we can't go down the road of air conditioning because that just adds to the problem. That's a fool's errand, surely, on every front, because it actually pushes warm air into the environment as well as the electricity issues. Yes, totally agree. It is a massive issue. I'd love to see the planners get on top of that in a true leadership sense. I'm not saying they don't, but it would be good to see more evidence of it. Yes, madam.
Just out of interest, when I talk to health people that's coming here today, they went, what's the weather got to do with health?
Yeah.
And when I talked to a primary school teacher and then other teacher friends, they said that whenever the wind was high, the children's behaviours have been really grown bad.
Yes.
So I don't know whether there might be a forecast possibility for yourselves for education as well as health. The other thing, though, was in the 1980s, I was doing research looking at stress within social work, and I remember reading an article by a GP in the west of Scotland talking about how our weather, the microclimate here, seemed to have significant physical effect, and I remember people poo-pooing it. Mm. And I'm just wondering, when you talked earlier about the Glasgow effect, whether you might speak a little bit more about that.
I concur totally, but we have not looked into it. I mean, it is everywhere has its own microclimate. For a start, I've worked all over the world in meteorological terms, and everywhere, bar none, has a microclimate to a lesser or greater extent. And I firmly believe the evidence is emerging that it does affect the character and the health of the people in that vicinity. I mean, the mental health issue is massive in places like Austria and Switzerland. When the wind blows from the south, there's a wind called the Föhn, which is a very dry, very warm wind, and it's come over the Alps from the Mediterranean, and it pours down on top of Austria, northern Austria, and it's known as the crazy wind, or something like that, because it's got huge numbers of admissions from mental illness rise astronomically in the days after that, and there's all sorts of domestic violence issues linked with that wind. That's an extreme one, because the Alps are very high and drive this very dramatic effect. But it'll happen over the Grampians for Inverness, when the wind's from the southwest. I'm not sure. I'd like to say Inverness has got a crazy wind, but there you go. And the same will happen with the central belt of Scotland, for instance, when you're in a northerly wind coming over the bulk of the high ground of Scotland, coming down into the lower region. You will see aspects of that, and which will drive behaviour. I've not fully answered your question, but yes is the answer. But we've not had time to look at it. Yes, sir.
This is the last question.
Yes, of course.
I was going to ask you if your nice new headquarters in Exeter had a green roof, and if not, why not?
It has got a reservoir on the top, actually, which is used for flushing the toilets. So it collects rainwater, and then all the loo water is brown water. We collect water in the ponds around the building as well, and that's reused for brown water. The building uses very little external energy, but it's got these two massive supercomputers, you know, two of the most powerful in the world, which use an awful lot of energy. But we use the heat kicking out from the supercomputers to heat the rest of the building. So we have come unstuck in the Daily Mail, of all places, of our green credentials. What hypocrites we are, espousing all this stuff, and then running two big supercomputers. It's a conundrum of modern life, isn't it? We couldn't do our business without... We couldn't have led this field, which the UK does in climate science and has done since its inception, without doing what we do. But we try to do it as green as possible. And there's many... You know, the whole building is run on green principles, but... Yeah, we try. Does that help? Is that the right answer? Let me show you this short clip, and I'm sure it'll send you off in good spirits.
Doctor makes his daily round of calls, you'd find yourself having a mighty busy time keeping up with him. Time out for many men of medicine usually means just long enough to enjoy a cigarette. And because they know what a pleasure it is to smoke a mild, good-tasting cigarette, they're particular about the brand they choose. In a repeated national survey, doctors in all branches of medicine, doctors in all parts of the country were asked, "What cigarette do you smoke, doctor?" Once again, the brand named most was Camel. Yes, according to this repeated nationwide survey, more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette. Why not change to Camels for the next 30 days and see what a difference it makes in your smoking enjoyment? See how Camels agree with your throat. See how wonderful and good-tasting a cigarette can be.
That's it.
We very quickly come to 6 o'clock, it seems. Just a couple of things to say. One is to highlight this flyer, which is for the next event on the 20th of April, David Gustav talking about the code of the street and how we should reinterpret morality. The second is to say that through that door on your way out, there's some refreshments and a chance to continue some of these conversations. And the last thing for me to do is to thank Wayne very, very much for a really interesting talk. And you said very early on that one of the challenges about all of this is communication. And I think that the balance that you had in your talk of some very real and immediate issues about health impact and what's happening now really helped to bring to life some of the longer-term, more abstract issues around climate change. So I found that a really powerful balance. And thank you very much again.